podcast playlist.
The losses were more than just numbers.
Where's the settlement trail? Where are the legal and financial records?
You're sticking your neck out there.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway.
Hi, Matt. I'm Lindsay Michael, and this is Podcast Playlist, your guide to the world of podcasting.
Today on the show, we take a look back at some of the big stories of 2017 with the journalists who were there.
We have in-depth reporting, investigative journalism, and the stories behind the headlines. But first, a story that we've all unfortunately become very familiar with. It seems like there has been nonstop allegations of sexual harassment from the entertainment industry and other industries now over the past few months. Matt, do you remember when it all started, which seems like so long ago, with the allegations against Harvey Weinstein?
And then since then, it's been almost impossible to keep up with the number of powerful men who have been exposed as people who have used their power for nefarious and unpleasant and, in some cases, unethical and illegal means.
It is,
in many ways, the story of our time.
It is. And the story originally came out of an investigation by the New York Times. And the story behind that investigation is really amazing as well. The long-form podcast spoke with one of the lead journalists on the Weinstein investigation. Here's host Aaron Lammer speaking with Jody Cantor.
So this story is very much alive in the present tense.
I think the story's getting bigger, not smaller.
Bigger. Okay. So you would say we have not even reached the top of the mountain in terms of this story.
I think it's like a wave that hasn't receded yet.
Interesting.
I think more women are coming forward. We published a story with new assault allegations against Harvey Weinstein, and those date back to the 1970s. And so the timeline is now 40 years. And also the people are coming forward about other figures in other industries on a daily basis. Before I went to bed last night, I said to myself, I wonder what the news story will be tomorrow. And I went to sleep and I woke up this morning and the Kevin Spacey allegations had broken.
Is this the response you expected?
So there's a group of sources who I always thought were wrong. I sat through a lot of interviews and so did my partner, Megan Toohey. Over the summer, we're kind of jaded Hollywood executives, former Weinstein and Miramax employees, said things to us like, oh, Jody, everybody's known about this for decades. It's an open secret. Nobody cares. Nobody's ever cared. They would also tell us that, like, the Times was going to kill the story, which was ridiculous. And then they would say things like, you're going to publish your little story and life will go on. So I'm very glad to know that those people are wrong. And I also think that as a journalist, there's almost always a point at which somebody tries to talk you out of the idea that you have a story. And it's really important to listen to them, not literally, not obviously they're trying to kind of gaslight you and convince you that you don't have something that you know you have. But I think there's always a clue somewhere in there that teaches you about the greater meaning of the story. So those people, I think, are totally wrong. I'm glad they're wrong. Because I don't think this just happened. I think that there's a lot we invested in this, and there's a lot the Times invested in this journalistically. And so while I'm staggered by the reaction, I'm also satisfied by it, because this is why we wake up in the morning, right? I mean, this is why I come to work. The part of the idea of investigative journalism is to take things that are really hard to talk about and make them easier to talk about. And that seems to be happening a little bit.
I want to talk to you about your whole career, not just, I know that this probably feels like a giant thing right now, but you've also been at the center of big stories before that have involved powerful, famous people. But let's go a little bit through the Weinstein thing first. You cited sort of two periods, right now, which is this rolling snowball period, and a period in the middle where it seemed like maybe less clear exactly what course this is going to take. Let's go back further to when you very first started working on this story. So how did the story come to you?
So the Times has made a really big investment in sexual harassment reporting this year. This was long and this was hard and it took a lot of resources. And it involved a pretty big team. And I think the sort of natural place to date things is to really talk about the O'Reilly reporting that Emily Steele and Mike Schmidt did last spring. They uncovered the fact that Bill O'Reilly had settled a long string of allegations by women, and they revealed that. And I think for us at the paper, it was kind of a wake-up call. Not that sexual harassment existed, because of course we knew that, but I think we took a moment and we said, we have this unique power as investigative journalists to put the puzzle pieces together, because it's very hard for any one woman to come forward on her own. Even though we're now in a kind of Me Too moment, even now it's still pretty hard for women as individuals to come forward alone. But if we go back and we say, where's the settlement trail? Where are the legal and financial records? How can we trace this? How can we determine whether there was a pattern of allegations here? Then we can play kind of a unique role in bringing these stories to light. So Emily and Mike did that. And then the editors asked me to do reporting, and they said, you know, essentially, also Katie Benner did a really important story about women in Silicon Valley, women who were entrepreneurs who were pressured inappropriately by investors for sex.
And I had like, there's been so many of these stories that I had totally, I mean, those were both big stories. And I feel like, not that I forgot them, but it's been a lot in all in 1 year.
But those were really important because they helped give us a playbook and they helped convince us that we were onto something. And also, I want to go back to your question of how I got to Weinstein, but when I was talking to the Weinstein sources, those stories gave my sources hope, because as Megan and I were reporting this summer, we were able to go back and say, hey, listen, the Times executed the O'Reilly stories well, the Silicon Valley stories went well, we were able to document things, the women were believed, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, so the editors came to me and said, what do you think are the big sexual harassment stories in America that are going untold? And I had done, you know, years of kind of gender-oriented reporting at this point. So I had heard some things and I had some ideas, but I did some reporting. And I came back pretty quickly and I said, we have to try Weinstein. And it felt like Mount Everest, because so many great journalists had tried before us. And it was, as many people have noticed now, it was kind of hiding in plain sight. It was both strangely public with jokes about it in popular culture, and yet it had never been documented. So I was wary, but I felt like we had to try.
That was an excerpt from the Longform podcast. It's hosted by Aaron Lammer, Matt Linsky, and Evan Ratliff.
Today, we're looking back at the big news of 2017. If there's a podcast you think we should know about, tell us on Twitter at Podcast Playlist.
We're talking about sort of the stories of our times. One of them is, of course, the Me Too movement and the fact that people, women, but some men as well, have felt emboldened to come forward with accusations and allegations of harassment and more. One of the other stories of our times is migration and the movement of people. There are millions of people who are on the move, often forcibly, in our world all at once. Earlier this year, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees fled Myanmar, escaping a military crackdown on the Rohingya ethnic minority. It resulted in violence and many dead. The United Nations and others have said that this is textbook ethnic cleansing. A majority of the refugees have found their ways to camps in Bangladesh. And while they've escaped the violence, the situation that they find themselves in there is still dire. Shoka Chafi is a photojournalist for Al Jazeera. He was documenting the refugee camp in Bangladesh with his editor, Saif Khalid. Here they tell Jasmine Bayomi, the host of the Debrief podcast, what they saw.
What used to be empty land just a few months ago in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, just across the Naf River from Myanmar, is now teeming with broken people, living in tents made out of reed and tarp, happy to be alive, but desperate for food, medical care, and basic sanitation.
One thing I want to say here, it is not normal refugee crisis, what we have seen in the world. It is beyond, it's a different refugee crisis. I know every pain is like, for every person, his pain is very painful, you know, like, but this is something different. It is not a normal refugee crisis. It is not, it's like a sea of people. They have come from, they escaped saving their lives. They have seen atrocities all over their life. All over their life, they have seen atrocities. They have never seen any happiness in their life. Now they came to another country, which is also poor, and they saved their life, but maybe they will die of hunger now.
I think many people underestimate what it takes to come to Bangladesh. What's the journey that they have to take?
The situation is really very tense over there. The people, they are coming by boats, and when they reach near the border of Bangladesh, they don't wait for the boat to reach to exact border. They jump from the boat and they swim and they reach to the border. The people who are coming from there, they have nothing with them. Most of them, when they reach to the shores of the Bangladesh, they faint there because they have been walking for many days. You can see by their physical appearance, like, they are not eating well in their own country. But the problem is they are coming to Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries of the world. And there, they are living in a small space. More than 500,000 people are living in such a small space. Like, there are people everywhere. You can see, like, if you see towards right or left, there are people everywhere.
Wow, that sounds like it's really, really chaotic.
It is very chaotic over there. Like, there are people everywhere. Wherever you see, there are people. There are people, and they are like running for food, and they are looking for food. They are looking for shelter.
So that chaos, like, what other symptoms does it show? Like, what scenes have you guys witnessed that are just so symbolic of the chaos that's going on?
There are many aid agencies helping them, international aid agencies, local people, local charities. And when a truck with the aid comes, the people jump over the truck. The healthy people, the men who can run, they jump over the truck and they take the food from that. The women, the old and the children, they are left behind. It's like the survival of the fittest over there. That is the problem. And international aid agencies and the local charities, they are really struggling to reach out to all the people.
I interviewed this woman, actually. I wrote a story on her. We were near an aid truck. Hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 Rohingyas were actually just, they were trying to grab a packet of aid. That woman was, she couldn't go into that because, you know, she was holding her one-year-old child on her lap and she was crying. What brought my attention is not just her cry. It was raining and that kid was sleeping. A normal kid would never sleep while it's raining. Naturally, I was like really, it kind of really like, broke my heart. And then I approached her and then I started talking to her. Then I put my umbrella over the kid so that, you know, that doesn't go out of my mind. So it's that kind of situation. It's that level of helplessness. She said that her husband was killed. So she is here on her own with two of her kids. One was 2-year-old, one is 1 year old. So what do you do to that? It's not that, you know, people are not helping. People have been very generous. Bangladeshi people have been very generous, especially after their prime minister announced that, you know, they're ready to help them, though it's a poor country, but they have opened up their hearts and, you know, houses for them.
Was there a situation you just weren't mentally prepared for?
I had never been to that kind of situation. It was really heartbreaking situation. At times when I was interviewing that woman I described earlier, my translator started crying.
Shaukat, how about you?
I have been to Europe and covered the European refugee crisis, and that was really bad. In my head, it was like I thought it will be same. But I have to say it was worse than that. It was really worse than that. And I had never seen such a terrible thing in my life. So I was not really prepared for this kind of a thing.
I think one of the most difficult story for me was the children's story, which I did. And it was very difficult to ask a 9-year-old and 10-year-old about the fact that, you know, his or her father or parents were killed, butchered by the Myanmar army. Children as young as 10 years old narrated that they saw when the attack happened, they ran and hid in the bushes. One of them, a 10-year-old Rashid, he's still not come out of his shock and, you know, trauma. And he has his 6-year-old sister to take care of. I spoke to the counselors there. They said that, you know, every often he comes to them and asks them that, you know, my dad and my parents were killed by the army. And other significant thing which I observed and which every Rohingya, including the children, pointed out, the army. There's a fear of the army among them. They don't talk about Suu Kyi or anybody else. They only talk about army, fear of the army.
That was the Debrief podcast from the Al Jazeera Network. It's hosted and produced by Jasmine Bayomi with audio editing by Lorinto Colantanina.
This next story kind of flew under the radar for a number of people this year, but it's worth delving into. Rosalind Adams was an intern at BuzzFeed. She was going through some documents when she came across information that kind of piqued her interest. The investigation that followed took her deep into a corporate cover-up. She discovered that the largest psychiatric hospital chain in America has been keeping people against their will, without proper justification, all in the name of making a profit. She shared her story with the ProPublica Breakthrough podcast. Here's Rosalind Adams speaking with the host, Jessica Huseman.
It was definitely one of those stories where this whole world opens up as you start making phone calls and start asking people questions. The way that I started reporting was actually just flipping through 10Ks of hospital companies.
A 10K is a company's annual report to its investors. All publicly traded companies are required to file one. They're public records, so anyone can access them. In these filings, companies have to disclose any major legal proceedings. And what Rosalind finds is that the Office of the Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has subpoenaed some of UHS's hospitals.
That immediately was a tip of where to start looking. So the first hospital I started looking into was Riverpoint Behavioral Health.
Turns out that the federal government has been investigating this facility in Florida and several other UHS hospitals for possible Medicare fraud.
So when I pitched the story, I really just started with the question of what is the nature of this federal investigation into UHS? So I just sort of approached it like the way that you would, you know, background a person, like the hospital is sort of your character. So I checked lawsuits. I started reaching out to patients first, just really on Yelp and Google reviews, because that it's just such an unfiltered look at somebody's experience there, you know.
So what do those reviews say?
They were like, they definitely addressed quality of care. But a bunch of them were like, I was being held here against my will. But I still didn't have any idea that that's really what the story was about, because it didn't seem unusual that a patient at a psych hospital would say I was being held against my will. That's sort of what a psych hospital does. But I reached out to a few people there. And one of the first people I talked to was a husband who had gotten into an argument with his wife and had taken her there for just basically like an evaluation. They had been fighting. She was upset. And it seemed to sort of make sense, like, oh, she could talk to somebody here, and had been committed. And then when she was committed, the hospital was very cagey with him, and he was like, you know, I don't think she needs to be committed. I think we had a fight. I think this is something that will pass. And then he felt like different medications were being forced on her, felt like she didn't really need to be there, felt like she was sort of kept too long.
At first, Rosalind thinks maybe the story is about involuntary commitment. Florida has a law that allows police, doctors, judges, and mental health workers to hold someone against their will for a mental health examination for up to 72 hours by filing a petition in court. On the county court website, she's able to see the address of who filed the petition for involuntary commitment. And it's often Riverpoint. Rosalind's also able to see the names of patients who are involuntarily committed, so she calls them. She also calls a public defender who's worked on some of these cases. And he echoes what she's heard former patients say, that some people are committed to Riverpoint who don't need care, while other people who do need care but don't have insurance are turned away.
So pretty quickly, just by, you know, doing the normal things you do, like check lawsuits, check online reviews, call lawyers, this picture sort of started to emerge. when I started talking to employees at River Point, then that put a lot of what I had heard from patients into context. And that was when I first heard this phrase, don't leave days on the table. And that the way that employees interpreted that phrase, or the way that they felt like it was communicated to them, was that if somebody has insurance coverage left, don't release them from the hospital. All of that came together pretty quickly. I would say within like, you know, a few weeks, maybe more than a month. Like I had had, you know, lawyers, a public defender, employees, and a couple of patients like talk about their experience at this hospital. So I had a lot of confirmation from different sources pretty quickly.
And so you bring that to your editor. What does he say?
I went back to my editor, Mark Schuffs, and I was like, well, should we publish this story on One Hospital? And Mark, who's a great and fantastic editor in person and loves big stories, was just like, why would we publish a story about one hospital when we could publish a story about 200 hospitals? And as a reporter, I was like, yeah, totally. Okay, let me figure this out. But it was incredibly daunting.
Rosalind builds a spreadsheet of the 200 UHS hospitals across the country. She adds in names of patients, employees, and former employees. And then she starts calling people.
I'm sure I called thousands of people, yeah. I'm sure.
How did
I
you get all these names?
So I used LinkedIn. I used the Wayback Machine,
which catalogs old websites. So you were looking at hospital websites and looking at old names of administrators and things like that?
Okay. Yeah. When I was trying to find hospital administrators to talk, the Wayback Machine was especially helpful because usually these hospitals will list the clinical leadership of the hospital or just general leadership of the hospital. So you can at least find like the CEO, CFO usually on the website. And then if you search older versions of the website, it'll give you other names.
So Rosalind started calling all of these people, and when they didn't respond, she'd knock on their doors until she approached one former hospital executive and received a letter at work.
And then as it like the letter was like, your reporter, Rosalind Adams, was knocking on employees' doors in Colorado. And you're like, you know, a little bit of you is like, wait, how did they know that? Like, surely probably somebody called them. But yeah, it totally makes you a little paranoid as things are going on.
So Rosalind started to piece together how these hospitals work. By this point, she's heard a lot of patients and employees complain about mistreatment in different UHS hospitals across the country.
So, again, there was a point in the reporting process where I had submitted a draft and I sat down with my editors and they were like, you know, this is really good, but, you know, from our perspective, the pattern that's happening at these hospitals is so clear, you know, what is the connection to corporate? And so what I knew was that the most direct, the best chance I had to sort of get at what corporate was instructing people to do was through the hospital CEO level. And I told my editors, I was like, I really don't know if this is going to work because I'd already talked to like 10 at that point. And so my strategy was like, well, I will just be exhaustive of finding as many hospital CEOs as I can. I was like, at least then I can go back and be like, I've tried everyone.
So Rosalind goes through the same steps she's used to find employees, Wayback Machine and LinkedIn. She makes a new spreadsheet with every UHS hospital and every CEO for the past 5 years.
And I just built this like insane spreadsheet of like, you know, 200 columns and tried to find as many CEOs as I could that had left. And from that gave me a list of like 75 more people to call. And I just called all of them. And that was how I got 3 CEOs to confirm that they had been directed to fill beds no matter what, that they were told don't leave days on the table, which was sort of this coded directive from the corporation, like if a patient is given X number of insurance days, use all the insurance days.
So tell me about the first CEO that told you that. What was your reaction?
Oh my gosh. Actually, I very, very clearly remember this because I told my editors, I was like, I was like, I will absolutely do this and I will absolutely go full force at this. But like, keep your expectations low kind of thing, you know?
Okay.
So I remember it was like Friday night and I was like working my way through this list. And, you know, I was talking to the CEO and I was like, did you ever hear the phrase like days on the table? That was usually how I asked it because it was a lot less loaded way to ask it. Like instead of being like, were you told to keep patience no matter what? You know, it was like, did you ever hear this phrase days on the table? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, it was like one of those moments where you're like, oh, okay. And then you're like, and I was like, well, what did you take that to mean? And he was just so matter of fact about it. He was like, well, yeah, it was like a way to like increase revenues because you have to like use all the insurance days. And I was like, and who told you that? He was like, everybody talked about it. And he was like, I heard it at conferences. I heard it from my boss. And I was just like, wait, I don't even know. Cause I'd been working so hard to get that one thing. And he was so just like, yeah, what else do you want to know? I was like, oh my God, I need to think of more questions to like ask. He was like, well, his attitude was just so like, well, yeah, obviously. And I was like, oh my God, dude, I've been trying to get somebody to confirm this for like months.
So it was a Friday night. Were you like alone in the office or was totally. There somebody you could hang up and be like, guess what I just found?
No,
what did you do?
I was like totally alone in the office. I immediately called Mark and I was like, guess what happened?
Awesome. So Roslyn cracks the pattern. Don't leave days on the table is code, and it's tied to top executives at UHS. But she still doesn't have any documents, and she needs physical proof. Then she gets a voicemail from another source, saying that she's on to something and he has proof. She calls him and sets up a meeting.
And, you know, he was very upfront. He really felt like the company had screwed him over, and he felt like what the company was doing was wrong. And at his particular hospital, the profit margin had gone from like 13% to 56%, something wild like that. And he was just like the profit margin is never high enough. It was never high enough for my boss. Like they always wanted more. And so, yeah, we were, you know, talking and I asked him if he had any documents from his time there. And he was like, oh, well, I have like 7 boxes in my home of documents. And it was just like that moment where you're like, oh my God, I've been looking for these documents forever. Like, I didn't think they existed. And I just tried not to be too eager and not to be too like forthcoming. But I was definitely still like, well, I could just drive to your house right now. And he was like, no.
But he eventually let you.
Yeah, we met the next day and he came with like a huge stack.
A huge stack of documents, internal budgets, how admissions were tracked. Rosalind's able to confirm exactly what she's been hearing. She finally has physical proof, but she's still nervous.
I mean, I was really nervous towards the end before publishing. Like, I mean, I think the scary part of investigative reporting is, you know, you're the first person to expose something. You're sticking your neck out there.
BuzzFeed publishes the story, and the response is swift. UHS disputes the federal investigation and points out that it has never been charged with any wrongdoing. UHS, quote, absolutely rejects claims that its hospitals held patients for financial gain and says that Rosalind's story is based on anecdotes and is, quote, contrary to the factual records and UHS policies and practices. Rosalind gets hundreds of emails from doctors, nurses, patients, people who had all come into contact with UHS. So BuzzFeed sets up an anonymous tip line, and she gets hundreds of tips.
From the Breakthrough podcast, that's Rosalind Adams speaking with host Jessica Huseman. If you want to hear the rest of that story, head over to our website, cbc.ca/podcast playlist, and you will find a link there.
Matt, I'm sure you've heard this word in the past year, Antifa.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Do you know the origins of that word, though?
No, I don't. I mean, you hear it a lot in relation
right.
to what's going on and the way that people are pushing back against the rise of the so-called alt-right
mm-hmm.
In the United States. But I actually don't know where that word comes from.
Right. And neither did I. So I was really interested to learn about it in this next podcast The World in Words from PRI looked into the history of the word Antifa. Here's reporter Lydia Jean Cott in conversation with hosts Patrick Cox and Nina Porzucchi.
But here's how one Antifa activist, he didn't want me to use his real name, so I'm going to call him Peter. Here's how he says it.
So I pronounce it Antifa.
So Antifa.
Yeah, and let's go with Peter's pronunciation, at least for this story, because this is kind of really Peter's story. How did you start organizing? Like, did you Google Antifa?
It was really just like just getting involved in even just like more basic community organizing in any sort of group like that. There's going to be somebody who's like down for a little bit more. And then, you know, you talk to that person, you meet somebody else who's kind of down for a little bit more. And it's sort of, there are just people around who are kind of willing to take it one step further.
Peter is from Charlottesville. Again, that's not his real name. He didn't want me to use his real name because he doesn't want to become a target for white nationalists. He's a college student with dark rimmed glasses and a shy, closed-lipped smile, studying physics and philosophy. I first reached out to him back in July.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Yeah, sorry about that. I just like forgot my login. He was living at his parents' house and working a summer job between his sophomore and junior year of college.
Oh, that's totally fine. I haven't used Skype in years either.
The word Antifa was just starting to appear in the news, and I wanted to learn more about it from someone directly involved.
For me, Antifa means just a movement that's dedicated to resisting all forms of oppression. And generally, those tend to lead towards an anti-capitalist movement. Not everybody who's involved is an anti-capitalist, but that is a pretty predominant part of the ideology.
Peter is careful when defining Antifa because Antifa isn't one organized group. There's lots of different groups and different people associated with Antifa who aren't really part of any group at all. But most people who are involved do tend to be pretty far left. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they believe in no platforming. That's a word for doing everything you possibly can to keep racists and fascists from spreading their ideas by expressing their views in public. That can mean publicly shaming them or even physically confronting them. Like, for example, in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day, what looked like an Antifa activist punched the white supremacist Richard Spencer in the face while he was giving an interview.
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
That video went viral. It got remixed to endless songs, including Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture.
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
And that's around the time Peter got on board.
I know for me, certainly, I really would not have considered any of this kind of organizing to even be necessary before Donald Trump was elected.
So back in July, for Peter, his involvement with Antifa, it was still pretty new. Have you participated in any sort of like violent protests or violent actions?
I personally have not. However, yeah, there is a lot to talk about for that. So if you have a more specific question.
So like you wouldn't be opposed in certain situations using violence?
Correct. But I also believe that nonviolent action should be always the first step. But there are going to be people who, and especially on the far right, who, as I guess we all know, they have a very big thing for guns and for us to stand around and not be prepared to defend ourselves is an absurd idea.
At the time, I thought of this conversation between me and Peter as theoretical. I was wrong. One reason why Antifa is so difficult to define is because it's not actually in the dictionary.
What do you mean by that?
Like, it's not in Merriam-Webster, at least. It's a term that they're watching or tracking to see if it gets used enough to eventually get added.
Oh, so where did the term originally come from?
I asked Mark Bray that. He's a history professor at Dartmouth and the author of a book that's actually called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And here's what he told me.
The anti-fascist movement is as old as the fascist movement. It originated in the early 20th century in response to the rise of Benito Mussolini and fascism in Italy and its expansion elsewhere.
So the roots of the word Antifa also start in Italy. When Mussolini was coming to power, there was this paramilitary group called the Black Shirts, And they would go after and just beat up the people that didn't agree with him. And a lot of those people were leftists. So leftists came together and formed their own militias to kind of fight back. And since Mussolini's party was called the National Fascist Party, when the English-speaking press was writing about what was going on in Italy, they referred to those people who opposed Mussolini as anti-fascists.
Anti-fascists. Wow. Okay. So that's anti-fascist. But what about Antifa, the abbreviation? Did that start around the same time?
A little later, and it started in Germany. When Hitler was coming to power, he copied Mussolini, and he had a paramilitary group that beat up anybody that didn't agree with him. That group was called the Brown Shirts. And they also particularly went after leftists. So again, leftists formed their own groups to fight back. And one of those groups, excuse my German, I don't really know how to pronounce it, but it was called Antifascistische Action. And because that's kind of hard to say, it became known as Antifa for short.
Die Kommunistische Partei Deutschlands ruft euch zur antifaschistischen Aktion auf.
So this is a speech by an organizer named Ernst Schneller. He's calling for social democrats and communists to come together and join the fight against the Nazis under the mantle of this group, Antifascistische Action.
Sozialdemokratische Partei und Gewerkschaftsmitglieder. Eure Führer reden auch von der Einheitsfront.
So what then happened to that group and others like it when World War II actually broke out?
They all pretty much were crushed.
Crushed. So it failed.
Yeah, it failed. But I mean, I guess what Antifa activists would say that maybe if people had really all come together, like that guy Ernst Schneller wanted them to do, like all these different leftist disparate groups, which didn't really, but if that had happened and if they had understood the urgency of this cause, then maybe they would have been able to stop Hitler from rising to power and history would have been entirely different.
So many scenarios in which history would have been entirely different. Going back to the word Antifa, how did this nickname for this group that fought the Nazis in the 1930s become the name of an entire movement here now in 2017?
So let's skip ahead 50 years. Here's Mark Bray.
The term was sort of revived largely, I'd say, in the 80s out of initially West Germany and then a united Germany as neo-Nazis and far-right movement became resurgent with the fall of the Berlin Wall.
So some leftist radicals were feeling like the German government at the time wasn't doing enough to combat the violence that was coming from racist far-right groups. So they decided to take matters into their own hands and fight these groups themselves. And a lot of these groups, they hearkened back to the 30s as a way to gain legitimacy.
Oh, right. So did they have the same Antifa names as back in the 30s?
Yeah, I should probably say a lot of them had the word Autonome at the top of their name because that was the name of this broader leftist movement, kind of like the squatter movement that these groups came out of. So, for example, one of these groups was called Autonome Antifa Berlin. Another was called Autonome Antifa parentheses M because I think they met on Wednesdays and the German word for Wednesday starts with M. And there was even a coalition that was actually called Antifascistische Action, Antifa for short.
That was a clip from the podcast The World in Words. It's hosted by Patrick Cox and Nina Porzucchi. That story was reported by Lydia Jean Cott and the sound design by Tina Toby.
On the East Coast, concern is mounting around the North American right whale. This past summer, more than a dozen of the endangered animals were found dead, and now scientists, fishermen, and volunteers have begun rallying to save these whales. The CBC New Brunswick podcast, Deep Trouble, tells their stories. Here's Mafani Davis.
As more whales died this summer, the more serious the situation for the population as a whole. Philip Hamilton.
Profoundly discouraging. You know, the first death or two was, you know, shocking and upsetting. And then as they just kept coming, you know, up to at least 10 deaths in the Gulf St. Lawrence, 13 deaths along the eastern seaboard in total for the year. It's discouraging, frightening. I know that in general we're only seeing one in every four or five carcasses. I don't know if that was the case this summer, but if that were the case, then we've just lost, you know, a big chunk of the population.
The losses continued. Males, females, whales with numbers and names, others with no ID. But for Philip Hamilton, the losses were more than just numbers.
It's really, frankly, heartbreaking. You know, we're scientists who are collecting data, but in this case, it's data on individuals that we, and particularly I, know very well. So it's not just the loss of a data point. It is the loss of a life, and one that, you know, I'm familiar with.
Coming up. Boy, not showing much.
The discouraging and heartbreaking summer got worse in July. Fisherman Joe Howlett, co-founder of the Campobello Whale Rescue Team, a group dedicated to saving entangled whales, was killed while rescuing a right whale. A tragedy for everyone who knew Joe Howlett.
Well, this has been the worst summer of my life, losing my colleague Joe during that disentanglement. It's just the worst. And we were already having a bad summer because of all of the carcasses that had been found up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And we did have cautious optimism that this species was making a recovery. We'd had over 300 calves born since 2001, and they don't all live, but a lot of them had and started to have calves on their own. And so we had some cautious optimism that this species was making a recovery, but losing nearly 3% of the population this summer, any cautious optimism we had is erased.
That was from Deep Trouble, the North American Right Whale in Peril. It's hosted and produced by Mafani Davis and CBC New Brunswick. And that episode was produced by Carissa Donkin and Lauren Burt. You may remember this next story from last fall. A Toronto Star reporter went undercover as a factory worker at an industrial bakery following the death of a 23-year-old worker. Her month at a factory uncovered a lot about the precarity and dangers of temporary factory work.
Sara Mostahedzadeh shared her experiences at the factory and what she uncovered on the podcast IRE Radio, Investigative Reporters and Editors, Inc. Here's an excerpt of her conversation with Aaron McKinstry.
I tried to go about it as delicately and as responsibly as I could.
Then came another surprise. When it came time for Sara to pick up her paycheck, she didn't get it from the factory or the temp agency. Instead, she was given an address about a half hour from the factory. And when she got there, she found she was at a payday lender. You know, the places with bright neon signs advertising quick cash. They paid her in cash, provided no pay stub, and took out no deductions. That violated Ontario law, and it raised all kinds of questions for Sara.
What does the worker do if they get injured or don't get paid? And the temp agency that hired them is nothing more than a P.O. box, or, you know, the office doesn't really exist, or, you know, they're getting paid through this payday lender who has absolutely no, you know, obligations or relationship with them, really.
It's a situation she wouldn't have found out about if she hadn't gone undercover. After about a month, she felt like that information, coupled with her own experience working in the factory, was enough to tell the story. Her last day was a Friday, and she says she remembers it well.
We had been asked to come in on the Saturday. Our sort of schedules, like we would find out sort of last minute whether we would be working the weekend or not. And I remember the woman who I was working with on the production line that day, saying, you know, you should go home and rest. And she's a grandmother herself, you know, taking care of her family on top of working in this very physically demanding job. And I remember that day she was really in pain. Her back was really hurting. But she said, you know, I need the money, so I'm coming in tomorrow. And I just felt this really horrible sinking kind of feeling of guilt because, again, I had the choice to leave. I knew I wasn't going to come back.
Sara put in a call to the temp agency that hired her. Here's the audio from her call, which the Star published along with the final story.
I was placed at Sierra Foods, but we have a sickness in my family, and I'm not going to be able to go back to the factory. And I was wondering how I get my record of employment.
Oh, we don't do that. We don't issue a record of employment.
Oh, so should I ask the factory for it, or?
No, we don't do the record of employment, no job letters, and no pay stubs.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
No problem. Bye.
Bye.
They had photos from the hidden camera and Sara's personal experience. They had the data to back up their story. And they had several off-the-record interviews with the women Sara had worked with. It was important for her to protect their identities so they wouldn't lose their jobs at the factory. Sara said the women were surprised to learn who she really was.
I'm not sure that the people who I ended up sort of going back to and telling about the story and what was it was sort of focused on would ever feel comfortable articulating those things themselves. I think that they felt the story was accurate, and I think that's the best I can do as a reporter, really.
Now, Sara needed three things. To nail down an interview with Fiera Foods, to identify and interview the owner of the temp agency she'd worked for, and to identify the young woman who died in the factory shortly before Sara went undercover. But none of those things were easy. It took about a year from start to finish for Sara and her colleague Brendan Kennedy, an investigative reporter at the Toronto Star, to identify the temporary worker who died. Oddly enough, Sara said, Canadian authorities don't typically release the names of victims of industrial accidents.
We started off by trying to go all the official routes, so the Ministry of Labor, the coroner's office, the police station. We kind of took to just like hanging out at the police station nearby the factory in quiet hours, hoping that someone would tell us something.
None of that worked. So Sara started to think about the women she'd worked with in the factory and the communities they represented.
I knew that she was Muslim and that she had been wearing a headscarf. So I noticed that there were quite a few women from Eritrea who wore headscarves, who I worked with. So I started calling around the Eritrean community in Toronto.
She found someone who'd been working in the factory the day the woman had died. And that person thought the woman had been Zambian. So she tried calling the Zambian embassy, but no luck there.
I tried calling random Zambians in Toronto, was getting nowhere with that. And then a week later, this woman called back and said she'd got it wrong and that the woman was actually from Gambia.
So she called the Gambian Cultural Association in Toronto and a man picked up.
And I told him why I was calling and he said, oh yeah, that's my friend's wife. And it turned out that she wasn't from Gambia at all and neither was her husband. They just happened to be friends with this guy at the Gambian Cultural Association of Toronto. So it was really just pure luck in a way that we found them.
The woman's name was Amina Diaby. She was a 23-year-old recent immigrant from Guinea.
She had come to Canada escaping a forced marriage. She met her husband here. He was a refugee from Sierra Leone, and they wanted to start a family. She wanted to become a nurse. She was trying to save up for nursing school.
So she'd taken a job as a temporary worker in the factory. She'd only been on the job 2 weeks when her job got caught in the machinery.
To me, it felt like her story had sort of been forgotten in all of this. You know, this young woman with a really bright future ahead of her who'd come here to start a new life and died really just seemed kind of swept under the carpet.
Sara eventually found Amina's family, and they were open to talking with her.
So when I went to meet her husband, Sununu, it was an emotional encounter for me because I had spent so long looking for this family, and we felt so strongly that, you know, her story
deserved to be told and that she deserved to have a platform to talk about what happened in this really tragic workplace accident. And, you know, she deserved to have a name. He really felt that the communication with the authorities had been lacking, that he was really not kept in the loop as to what happened to his wife. And actually, you know, I had to be the one who sort of explained what I knew about what happened in the accident, because he still wasn't sure what had actually killed his wife.
Sarah shared what she knew. That following Amina's death, the authorities had issued a number of orders for health and safety violations, and that the machine that the headscarf was caught in wasn't properly guarded. But she said by that point, the details didn't really matter to him. He'd lost his wife, and he was devastated.
Her husband told me that he had become so disillusioned with his life in Canada. He'd come here, you know, to set up a new life and sort of start afresh. And then this horrible accident happened, and he felt like he wanted to go home. He wanted to go back to Sierra Leone, but he couldn't because he couldn't afford to repatriate her body, and he buried Amina in Toronto, and he didn't want to leave her behind.
In a video interview with the Toronto Star, Amina's brother-in-law explained that the day she died, the factory didn't even shut down.
I work on a construction site. Even if somebody break their leg, the job site will shut down. I know that. But this factory seemed like nothing happened. So nothing, like nobody cared. Even the people who were supposed to give you information, you ask them, they seem like they don't care. Like nobody, nothing stopped, no job stopped. So that makes me even, like when I get there, when I see the ambulance, I say, you know what, she must be okay, because nothing stopped. Like, you know, this is Canada. Like something, somebody died on a job site or something bad happened, they should stop the job, but nothing stopped.
He described Amina as full of life. Someone who could always make you laugh.
That was IRE Radio, Investigative Reporters and Editors, Inc. It was hosted and reported by Aaron McKinstry and edited by Sarah Hutchins. Blake Nelson does original artwork for each episode. And that's it for our show this week.
Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your podcasting app of choice. And email us your favorite podcasts, podcastplaylist@cbc.ca.
Podcast playlist is Aisha Barmania, Kate Evans, Phil Lung, Anne Lang, Amelia Scherer, and Arif Noorani. My name's Matt Galloway.
I'm Lindsay Michael. Happy holidays.